welcome everyone to another episode of Disrupting Privilege, conversations around race and health. My co-host today, many of you have met before, is Mary Richardson Lowry. Mary is a retired partner from Mayer Brown Law Firm, as well has been a more or less permanent fixture in the philanthropic fabric of Chicago throughout most, if not all, of her career, chairing many different boards across Chicago, and is on the Equal Hope Board and is the chair of our governance committee. Mary, welcome again to Disrupting Privilege.
I'm delighted to be here with you again, John, and looking forward to the substantive conversation I know will unfold with the doctor.
Terrific. Well, thank you. Well, we're very excited today to welcome Dr. Pam Khosla with us today. Dr. Khosla is with Sinai Chicago Hospital. She's a board-certified oncology and hematology specialist. She received her medical training from her home country in India. She migrated to the United States in 1990, where she completed her residency at what was then the Fitch University Health System or Health Sciences. It is now known as Rosalind Franklin University, University of Medicine and Science. After some time away from Chicago in New Orleans, Dr. Khosla came and joined us back here in Chicago at Rush University Medical Center, and is now the chair of the Cancer Committee at Sinai. Dr. Khosla, welcome to Disrupting Privilege.
Thank you, John, for that nice long introduction. I do want to add, I'm also the Division Chief of Hematology Oncology for Sinai Chicago. And we've changed the name of the institution officially to Sinai Chicago because we've expanded to Holy Cross Hospital, which is a little south of us, and the consortium of different entities that constitute Sinai, including the rehab facility, well-known Schwab Rehab, Children's Hospital, the Sinai Urban Health Institute, Sinai Community Institute. So, yes, very proud to be part of Sinai Chicago, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'm sitting here laughing a little bit at myself because that's a more or less a bonehead mistake on my part. I'm married to a woman who ran an advertising agency for 20 years, and branding is very important. And I did know it was Sinai Chicago, not Sinai Chicago Hospital. So shame on me for blending that.
No, I think that's a very, you know, every institution goes through a metamorphosis over time. And as doctors, we figure it out when your letterhead changes and when your email prompts change. And the best thing I've noticed just in the last few years since our new COO joined us, Dr. Erica Steed, the Sinai logo changed to better. You know, we're building better. And it was just a reminder that every new time there are administrative changes, the mission, the goals remain the core values, but there's a little bit of more impetus on doing things with a new vigor. And so, yeah, I am always excited to hear about what's happening in the healthcare field in our neighborhood, and very happy to discuss today with Equal Hope and the new organization, relatively new, that I understand.
In light of this sort of new branding and sort of reviving the essence of the core of Sinai Chicago, talk to us a little bit about SUHI, Sinai Urban Health Institute. It's an important entity here in Chicago, has, you know, connections across the city in many ways, but that was an important sort of step for Sinai Chicago. So share with us the story behind SUHI.
Right. I think SUHI is a gem that's somewhat known to people in the medical field and in Chicago. May not be so well known maybe outside of Chicago or out in the suburbs, but once you get to Sinai, and it's hidden in the oldest building in the hospital. But I think the most remarkable investment that Sinai Chicago has done in an institute that's comprised of researchers, epidemiologists, community health workers, And as I understand, the inception was prior to me getting to Sinai, but this was a big attraction of coming here. The founder was Dr. Steve Whitman, and I think Suhi was, the inception was back in 2000. Dr. Whitman worked with the Chicago Public Health Department as an epidemiologist and laid the foundation for some of the very core epidemiological work, especially around chronic disease, and was, I think, given the privilege and the opportunity to build this remarkable institution, which is probably the biggest research institution that's a partner with the largest safety net hospital in Chicagoland. So yeah, very proud to be part of that story and to see how in the last 16, 17 years I've been here, how Suhi has continued to evolve, and we've partnered more and more with the Sinai Urban Health Institute in the last 10 years or so.
Can you give the listening audience some specific examples of Suhi and its impact on the community at large? We have a broad audience, and so it would be useful for community members to have a fuller appreciation for why it matters.
Right. So I think I would not claim that I know the whole bandwidth of Suhi beyond the cancer arena to some extent, because Suhi is diverse. I think a lot of their work is focused on asthma, diabetes, but mammography screening was the key program in cancer care that I got engaged in. Right since the inception that, I've been here, like I said, over 15 years. And a key program called Helping Her Live is how I know we were literally knocking door to door with community health workers trying to encourage women to come in for a screening mammogram. There were community events held and continue to be held, and women are provided resources to go either come into Sinai or go to any community resource that may be convenient for them. But that whole community health worker role is, I think, what Suhi has really excelled in and is probably considered the leader in the west side of Chicago and probably in all of Chicagoland as an expert in training community health workers and giving them hands-on tools to go out and be, well-credentialed and provide quality services that a community health worker would be expected to. So, yeah, beyond, I think, the community health worker, Suhi has engaged in a lot of environmental scanning of our communities and going out and about and gathering some important surveys and publishing health surveys in the community, which we use actually for our Commission on Cancer Health Needs Assessment, which is a part of, what is it that your community needs the most in this case, just relating to the cancer service line. But, so they brought back focus from true research and investment in the community that we serve, trying to highlight areas that are of highest need. And I believe, diabetes, asthma, and some of the cancer services that were behind have been over the years highlighted. And we have actual data how to focus resources based on those services. Suhi works very independently within the organization. As I understand, and again, my facts are not directly based on administrative sources, but working with colleagues, they're grant-funded completely and have large grants to conduct this kind of research with a team that consists of PhDs all the way down to community health workers, and it's a large family of people very invested and passionate about what they do. And their engagement with the cancer service line started with mammography, but now we're exploring other areas, just like Equal Hope is expanding into cervical cancer screening. And last year, we started discussions about colon cancer screening and encouraging especially the African American community to keep up with, starting earlier with colon cancer screening, which 45 has been always the standard for the African American community, while it was 50 for the rest of the race-based communities. But now it's 45 for everybody to start colon cancer screening across the board. And it's a lot of focus, and we're trying to get grants in that direction to support that work. So we are always applying, identifying areas that could use more resources and community health workers.
Speaking of your founder, Steve Whitman had a pretty profound impact on the creation of the Chicago Metropolitan Breast Cancer Task Force, which is the predecessor name of Equal Hope, as well as Steve and one of our founders, Dr. David Ansel, were very, very close friends and we're in this battle together to ensure that healthcare is distributed equally across Chicago and not specifically to well-heeled zip codes. And so both of them have had a profound impact across Chicago, which is, you know, I know David has spoken many times before about Steve and misses him deeply because he had a colleague who truly saw eye to eye with.
Yeah, I think when I read the story, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please proceed.
When I wasn't here when that friendship and that collaboration started, but as I read through and Dr. Steve Whitman was still here and Dr. David Ansel had left by the time I joined Sinai, but I think anybody and everybody in Chicago knows Dr. David Ansel. Yeah. My husband was already here at Sinai, and Dr. Ansel had very much been instrumental in bringing him on board from University of Chicago while I was still at Rush. Their camaraderie or their professional relationship, and then, the way it comes to fruition with such an important milestone in West Side of Chicago, especially, it's just incredible. Yeah. I have to say it's inspiring when two great minds get together and make things happen. It just shows you how with collaboration and with the right intent and passion for something, both Dr. David Ansel and Dr. Steve Whitman have left a mark in the history of taking care of our most disinvested communities historically, and Absolutely. The most underprivileged that we've not, looked at it in a scientific manner. And when you put that scientific, epidemiological, research-based, data-driven, the largest study that was published that drew attention to the disparity in mortality in African-American women being so much worse than white women, and they announced the findings at a press release, and I had just joined Sinai at that time and was able to join, and it was just a moment of, I think, very mixed emotions, moment where we could now reflect and admit what had happened over the years and why we were where we were, but also a moment like, thank God we have real data and which will get attention. And it did get attention and, just started a story that keeps getting more national and local attention to the extent that I think we're very proud of where we are, 10 years later.
I think that that's important. What you did then is impacting where we are now and certainly informs where we want to go. Mm-hmm. And I say that just not about Chicago, but the cross-disciplinary engagement and SOC. I used to be outside counsel for Sinai in my small world among my client base. So I know a little bit about how you function. But the cross-disciplinary engagement, the direct importing, if you will, in health professionals within the community, that just wasn't happening. And it has informed systems around the country so that they can begin to think differently, as did the data that you gave voice to from the initial analysis done under Equal Hope in its predecessor form, and now informs how it moves forward. All that is so critically important and was not happening. And at the same time, women were getting sick and or dying prematurely because we weren't asking and answering the questions, demanding answers to those questions. And now we're in the throes of that process. Have a long way to go, but we're in the throes of that process. And in speaking of throes of the process, question for you is really around, given where we are in health literacy and how that plays a role in health outcomes, what are some of our challenges, particularly given the underserved community, and how they internalize that information, as well as the doctors and how they approach and communicate with the underserved communities, each part being very important.
Right. I think the moment, you know, I had kind of a drastic change between the patient population I was seeing the first 10 years of my career at Rush and then moved to Sinai, but was very much aware why this move was very dear and near to me. And embracing that patient population that puts your doctor, or especially the cancer doctor, I can speak from that perspective, on this pedestal of like, you decide. And when someone says that to you, I cannot tell you as a physician, and I'm sure all my colleagues can associate with that, there is not a better or worse onus to put on somebody to say, you decide. That puts the whole burden of, am I making the best decision, when that person is putting their trust in you. So I think, in short, the answer to that question is, I feel we have the most diverse staff at Sinai as well. I think people are drawn to a certain professional satisfaction that comes out of working for the most disenfranchised or the most vulnerable patient population that we see. There is so much pride to take home at the end of the day in walking somebody who has probably survived trauma, has survived mental health, and now is dealing with cancer, walking them holding hands to the door and out, calling the transportation coordinator, and there's an interpreter on your side if it's a Latinx patient. I think it's just a heart-rending scene when somebody cannot read a consent or an informed consent for chemo. We've translated it into Spanish, but even for the English reader, and how diligently the nurse navigator, the social worker, the oncology nurse, the, every medical assistant, this is like family, okay? It becomes family in 10 days, 15 days, maybe a month, maybe 2 months, depending on the level of engagement everyone has. So that's how I feel coming to Sinai every day. You know, I have a list of 15 patients, and I have similar relatives, you know, maybe back home, and some extended families that cannot read. This was very much true from the background I come in. My mom could only go up to eighth grade and was not allowed to attend school. Those were the days that women were very much not encouraged to step outside the house. So to me, this was very, very, very natural to embrace the, what we would call the disabilities or the underpinnings of the society that has left some people behind to be patient. And, if you cannot make your patient understand what you're talking about, I think we failed them completely delivery of care to me is more important than coming up with a mathematical formula and prescribing a drug.
That is so amazing. And this is the first time I've ever heard something like that. And I really want to highlight this. So your patients say to you, you decide what my course of treatment should be.
Yeah, I would say when you look a patient in the eye, tell them what they have, and they see something that makes them build that trust and faith in you. And this is usually, you know, these are new patients. They've been just given a diagnosis. They're suffering from 15 things and overwhelmed with information. But when you stand close, hopefully hold hands, which we haven't been unfortunately able to do that all the time with the pandemic. But yes, I think you can feel each other's trust in each other. And yes, my patients will ask me two very simple questions, but the hardest to answer. What would you do in this circumstance? Or if this was a family member, what would you do? And I can tell you, any doctor can attest to that. That's a value. You cannot get away from that without being honest.
Yeah. And when they ask, what would you do? They have opened themselves up on several levels. And exactly. They've acknowledged the relationship, but they've also told you, I want to survive. So help me to get there. And I believe you, if I tell you to respond in a way that would reflect what you would do for yourself or your own family, that is reassuring, particularly for people of color who may not have had access, who may be seeing you or engaging with your staff in the formative stages, but it's also at the worst stage of their lives from their perspective, because they're hearing something they had hoped against hope that they would not hear. So the literacy in part is my takeaway is the voice, how you deliver the message, how you internalize what they say back, how you help them to navigate. Equal Hope is great about, has a whole staff of people that assist with navigation, and they have these incredible stories. But what I'm hearing is your direct engagement can impact, if you will, the walk a patient takes. And sometimes I suspect whether or not they'll come back for the additional care that is needed. Would you like to comment further?
Yes. So I think Institute of Medicine, in 2013 put out an alert that we need to focus on supportive care services to include, like, every patient should have psychosocial distress screening done. And that's what, the last 10 years I've invested in creating the Supportive Oncology Initiative at Sinai. It was funded primarily by Coleman Foundation all along. But psychosocial distress screening of every patient that goes through a variety of questions from their physical well-being is just the tip of the iceberg, because it will get captured in the medical history. But their psychosocial and their emotional health, there is so much emphasis on questions which are as, I would say, private or personal as, are you comfortable reading? Would you need to have somebody else come and help you with the reading? Do you have a pet at home? Are you alone? Would you want to discuss further about fertility and things that would get left on the wayside, because you're not addressing the whole human being with the way most of us learned medicine a while ago? But I think implementation of improving the quality of life of the patient and the family, I think that commitment is what gets you started with this whole discussion about supportive oncology, which is very near and dear to my heart. You come out as a young oncologist and your male patients are calling you a nurse. It's quite a hard landing. The first year you're making tough decisions, and nurse, can you go get the doctor? Was not very encouraging. But I think I've gone through a personal journey of my own growing up with my experiences from New Orleans, where we saw women from the bayou who had neglected a breast cancer, and we were doing the first trials in how to give them treatment, especially for radiation therapy, which is called brachytherapy, so they don't have to come back and forth. You know, the first few trials were being done and very successfully right then. So as a young trainee to back to Chicago, you know, to rush at a very high level tertiary care center where people have already had two opinions by the time they see me, the young, you know, oncologist trying to understand the world. And then to Sinai, where I thought I had kind of all the equipment I needed mentally and emotionally to professionally deliver what I needed to. But it was a whole growing up process again. I used to be defensive when a young woman with breast cancer came in and she was angry. And I did not understand that emotionally. What did I do wrong? The anger is not at me. The anger is about the diagnosis. It's about why did it happen to me? So I think recruiting the right team members. So the two things we address in supportive oncology is first, a very thorough psychosocial distress screen, focusing on housing, childcare, transportation, any and every spiritual health, anything that the patient could use out of the resources we have. Or we could tap into some community resources. And I see Equal Hope's website yesterday, and I was really, really happy to see how there's an updated list of resources in the community from, you know, Gilda's Club to Wellness House to community cancer support groups to American Cancer Society. It's all in there. So our first is going through the psychosocial distress screen and then delivering that quality of care to the patient where everything that's going to happen could just be smoothened out a little bit and patients could actually go through that journey together with their team that's going to stand by them to make sure it's a success story.
Well, a question that we had as a follow-up was on the quality, but you've just delivered that with a qualm, I might add.
Right, I would agree.
Because that was exactly what we were hoping to hear, that when you're talking about quality, it is not one-dimensional. It is multidimensional. You have to think about the whole person. And in thinking about the whole person, the whole team that approaches that person. So I like the way you presented the strategy. Yeah. That we use because it really does address the quality issues that continue to unfold for the underserved community. Sinai has been one of the pivotal institutions with respect to access.
I agree.
And so we know that there's a need for continuing access penetration that will have to happen. I assume that's largely around education. Is there anything you can add with respect to how we improve upon access for those who are underserved?
Right. I think Sinai has so many dimensions to the institution. There's a Sinai Community Institute under Deborah Wesley, the president there, who has a whole different, home visits by these case coordinators and intervention in adolescent health, behavioral health. I think I am always surprised, and even 15 plus years down the lane, still discovering some new way that we can help a patient. The social services is very well funded, which means any co-pays. Patients walk down to the pharmacy and there's a copay assistance needed. We jump to that. Social service has their own funds that they can directly write out of and forego at least a month's subscription, prescription for anything would be covered. And then we tap into all kinds of community health organizations to make that treatment deliverable to the patient. But like I said, the investment into deaf health, interpreter services, social services is amazing. And we're talking, when I came here even 15, 20 years ago, that was the case. It's just, it's grown more, it's galvanized and more structured. And this new focus on supportive oncology, from my perspective, was not a term we were using, you know, when I graduated 20 years ago from my fellowship. It's a new focus. It is about delivering quality care by people who are competent and trained. So the social worker, the CHWs, the nurse navigators, these are all people who keep up their enthusiasm and training. And we often say we inspire each other, you know, hold each other up to higher standards. And that's my main interest has been with participating in this Coleman Supportive Oncology Collaborative, which was started out of multiple institutions coming together with the help of the Coleman Foundation and having design teams from Northwestern collaborate with safety net hospitals like myself at Sinai and then Mercy, that's no longer. And I think they had up to about 35 institutions eventually that put together this whole collaborative that's approachable on the internet and is an ongoing story.
Let me jump in. I wanted to say I'm really glad we're talking about the Supportive Oncology Collaborative because, as you know, you and I met, Dr. Khosla, on a Zoom meeting when the Coleman Foundation was officially transferring the Supportive Oncology Collaborative from their website to our to Equal Hope's website. And it's now a resource for both clinicians as well as patients who are looking for information on how to deal with any aspect of either providing care or receiving care and managing through it. And so it is a tremendous asset for us to have that on our website. And we're grateful to the Coleman Foundation. I'm really curious. You had a fairly formative role in creating that, did you not?
Yes, I will take a lot of pride in saying yes. I am so happy when that collaborative was not even officially a collaborative. It started off as supportive oncology. You know, how we're going to bring up the standards for Institute of Medicine. And we got an invitation to say, would you want to participate? And Coleman Foundation had funded an infusion center at Sinai 15, 17 years ago. So they just asked us if we would. And I was so happy to jump on the opportunity. I still had, I think, some part of me with a fuzzy feeling leaving Rush and academia always is very scary and going into a more community setting in the sense you feel you lose that touch with the, you know, the highest levels of care in terms of quality and academic pursuit. So this made me feel like, okay, I can keep those bridges of connection with academia, but I think it wasn't just a one man or one woman show. It became like this emboldening thing where we were having meetings every couple of weeks talking about different areas. There are 20, 30 modules that have been created out of it and perfected by the experts, but we were in different phases over the years implementing them, and it has become the core way we provide care in supportive oncology, including, you know, physician training and mid-level training, and then patient handouts, family handouts, resources. It's the most comprehensive list that's constantly updated, and I'm so proud and so happy that it has found the right home with Equal Hope.
We are... you are proud of the work that you did to create this remarkable portal. And I will say that we are equally as honored to have been chosen by the Coleman Foundation to host this. And what a phenomenal resource to have for, you know, those who come across our brand and are looking for more information. We are excited to see what this does. I mean, this will drive traffic to our brand and to the work that we do. So we're very excited to have that.
Right. I think, go ahead.
No, please.
The simple issues, you know, a patient is going to start radiation but doesn't have dental care coverage, which many, many patients don't have dental care coverage. We serve, you know, 500 plus patients every month in the clinic itself, and 50% of them are Medicaid and a couple of Medicare. Very, very many patients don't have access to dental care. It is a key element before you can start head and neck cancer radiation, especially, and encourage before you start any kind of chemotherapy so you don't end up with infection. How do you make it happen, right? You're in the middle of a busy clinic, and how do you make it happen? And that's where I feel there's tangible changes in delivery of care, because people and minds came together and said, okay, we can have, you know, if a dentist can tell you, I will charge a flat fee, bare minimum fee. UIC has a dental clinic where it's run by residents, and many of the services are provided free. But you have to build relationships and know those networks and provide that easily to the patients. And that's, you know, just a simple example, but a lot of things like that have just come together into this amazing resource for caregivers as well as patients and families. And it's a very proud moment in Chicago history, I think.
Yeah. And I learned through Cook County Health and Hospital System when I was on their board how many patients arrive who have never seen a dentist, just never had, never seen one. So it's impacting of care, whether it's in the cancer space. Frankly, they may be housed in one of the jails. They may be being seen in other areas. So they built out an entire suite of dental care because it was difficult to get to some of the other areas of care, substantive area, in the absence of resolving those issues. And they knew there was a path to do so. But as you think about the cancer care continuum and where we, the biggest impact or challenges are in the disparity space, can you give voice to that so that those of us who are looking forward can think about where there are some opportunities or areas of emphasis?
Great question.
Right. I think as a society, I feel like we like to follow sensational news, sensational topics. And it's very difficult to sort out, like, what was the reason something became headline news. And generally, as I'm growing up, raising two girls who are, you know, very, very much invested into social justice and having these topics and discussions around the dinner table, I'm learning, you know, what you see is not the whole story. So to make it short, I would say diseases like cervical cancer have not had patient advocacy, have not had the press they needed. Women have been dying of cervical cancer because it's such a hidden stigma that women don't want to come forward with it. It grows inside for a long time without a word, signs, and symptoms. And there's a simple test that can easily and is probably one of the most successful screening tests, the Pap smear, to detect cervical cancer early enough that it can be eradicated pretty much. Why have we failed as a society to bring that to the forefront? You know, we kept going with breast cancer. I'm proud of where we have come with breast cancer. You know, we have 90% survival across the board, and most women are going to be cured of breast cancer. I think it's time to focus on diseases that haven't gotten the attention that they deserve, especially if we have preventable, easily doable solutions for them.
Well, now that we have a successful model, a disruptive model, and data to prove that over the past, you know, 8 to 10 years, we have really reduced the mortality rate for women diagnosed with breast cancer in Chicago. We had two doctors. Our expansion into cervical cancer happened because there was another doctor at Rush and one at UChicago Medicine that we're both seeing an alarming spike in later stage diagnoses of cervical cancer in middle-aged women. And they both said that this is almost 100% preventable if it's dealt with earlier on in life, and came to us and said, can you add cervical cancer to your platform? And our hope all along, once we had gotten to a successful place with our platform, was that we would find a way in which we could expand it to be more approach women's health in a more holistic fashion. And this was a natural fit for us. And then the pandemic just sort of blew the roof off. And the importance of having preventative care is now front and center. And we're sort of leading, I don't know if we're leading the charge, but we're certainly a key conduit to a segment of the city that is under-resourced. And so, you know, we're excited that finally the public narrative has come to where we have been trying to say for almost a dozen years that systemic racism is at the heart of this. And unless we deal with the systemic causes, we're just tinkering around the edges. And so we have been effective. We are continuing to be effective, and we look forward to expanding that in the future.
And we look forward to continuing to collaborate with Sinai.
So as we come to a close here, I want to be respectful of your time. You have a day job and you have to attend to other matters, I'm sure. So we want to, give you a chance to say a couple final words, but I'd like to just ask you, how can Equal Hope and Sinai Chicago tighten? We already have a fairly tight relationship, but what can we do? Is there something we can do to make this better? Or if not, we don't know right now, let's find out.
Right. I think, like I said, I'm very indebted to Coleman Foundation because they've held our hand for at least the last 20 years. There were not just improvements done in the cancer center, but there were improvements done across the hospital, the emergency room, many, many areas. So I am looking up to organizations like Equal Hope with a strong history and great foundation from their leaders behind them to continue this bridging the gap between academia and community hospitals. Mm-hmm. We're a teaching hospital. We have multiple residencies, fellowships. In fact, we're starting a Hemong fellowship, which I'm very proud as of July. So as we train young people, we want to train them the right way. And the best way to do it is to inspire each other and keep those bridges open. And I think with the peer models, the way they have changed, it is very easy to leave behind small hospitals to struggle on their own. Yeah. And the story at Mercy is heart-wrenching. With what happened. We've taken over a lot of patients from there, and one of the physicians was recruited at Sinai as part of our team. Very proud of being able to hold hands for those patients. I think if Equal Hope can continue to invest in those relationships between academia and community and safety net, that would be a great way to keep the relationships going and growing over time.
That's really interesting, and we do appreciate that. I know that we have been thrilled to be one of the partners with Sinai Chicago, and we cherish our relationship and look forward to finding more ways in the future for us to collaborate and coordinate with one another. With that said, I want to let you get back to your day job, but I want to just, if you don't mind, I'm going to say a little plug here for Equal. This is the first time you've listened to Disrupting Privilege, conversations around race and health. I'd ask you to do two things. Number one, if you're listening to a podcast, you got it somewhere. So if you would like it, or I think the word is like, you'd like this, that would be helpful. And if you wouldn't mind rating this, you can rate each episode. That also helps us to sort of penetrate the marketplace a little bit. We would appreciate that. With that said, Dr. Kosa, we are so grateful for your time and your insights. I want to say I'm going to come back to you because you said a few things that I really wanted to probe deeper to, but I wanted to give you a chance to finish your statements. I think that the next time we do one of these, I'd love Dr. Summer Dudney to join us, who I don't know if you know Dr. Dudney from Rush, but she was one of the two doctors that came to us that opened up the conversation around cervical cancer, is on our board. And I think the two of you would have remarkable insights into dealing with a male-dominated world of surgeons and doctors, because she shared some similar thoughts. And if I have to be the male sitting between that, I'm willing to do that, because I think the society will be better.
And that's important, but just allow the voices of the women to rise above.
That's why I stay quiet.
Make sure they speak. It really has been a pleasure hearing your perspective and having you impart some wisdom to our audience. That in large part, the reason why I'm here is the importance of the issue. And in its absence, there will be a loss of life. And we can largely control much of that in educating, by being better participants, by being better informed. So I am grateful that I was asked to be a part of this discussion, and I really value your voice.
Well, thank you so much. This was really, I think there's not too many moments I tell my staff when it's show and tell for doctors. It's generally just prescribe, and hope it happens, and then pick up the pieces with the next clinic. Yeah, I think these moments give you time to reflect on yourself and connect with the world and put everything in perspective. So thank you. This was very, very introspective for myself, and makes you look back at your own journey.
Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back in touch soon, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye now.